Good afternoon. Well, folks, I had a nice trip up to Vermont, and I finally found and photographed that petrified Indian boy, which caused such a sensation some 75 or 80 years ago, and about which so many of you have asked for additional information. And here's how the whole business started. One day back in January 1871, when Mr. George Parsons of Springfield was visiting down in Turner's Falls, he got a hankering for a rabbit stew. So he enlisted the services of a hound dog named Bose and the two boys the dog belonged to. And off they went on a rabbit hunt. They were working along the riverbank not far from where those prehistoric animal and bird tracks, said to be millions of years old, had been discovered, when the hound dog began to howl. As the boys came up to him, he was sniffing at a hole in the rocks and pawing away at the frozen ground. Mr. Parsons got a long stick and shoved it into the hole, but nothing came out, so he went off in search of rabbits. But the boys, convinced by the dog's actions that he'd cornered something unusual, kept right on digging. The ground at this spot was gravelly and frozen, but they managed to break away several good-sized chunks, revealing a depression that looked rather suspicious. They were scooping out the loose stones and half-frozen soil when suddenly they uncovered what appeared to be a bare, brown, human foot. And that so frightened the youngsters, they scrammed out of that place and headed for home, with their hair standing right up straight. Thinking things over later, they decided they'd better tell Mr. Parsons, so they did. But as it was getting cold and dark, he said he'd wait for daylight before he did any more investigating. Well, the next morning, with pickaxe, cold chisel, shovels, and so forth, and a blanket to wrap the remains in, if such they proved to be, they all returned to the spot, which Mr. Parsons later described as being 40 rods from the bank of the Connecticut River, some 6 miles northeast of Greenfield, and roughly 12 to 15 miles from Brattleboro, Vermont. The sandstone, once firm and solid, had disintegrated into coarse, reddish-colored gravel, and Mr. Parsons had little difficulty in scooping it out a handful at a time. And as he scooped, there came to light the form of a small boy lying face down in what had been thousands of years ago the riverbed. Looking close, Mr. Parsons saw that one hand had been flattened by the pressure of the body upon it. And when he tried to lift the body, he couldn't budge it. Digging around, he found the figure was firmly attached to the ledge it rested on in two places, at one arm and at one leg. It's understandable he didn't want to leave the body there, and in trying to get it free, one foot broke off, as did one finger. But finally he lifted it and placed it in the blanket. The body was covered at that time with a thin grayish mold, but after being exposed to air and sunlight, this natural shroud dried and blew away, leaving what appeared to Mr. Parsons to be a stone statue, as he called it, of a boy about 6 to 8 years old. Chipping away the finger and foot, which were firmly attached to the rock bed, he placed them with the body and took the unusual find back to town. It was the opinion of those who saw it that years and years ago this young lad had fallen, struck his head on the rocks, and had died as a result of the injury. Then, said the local experts, his body was covered by mud and clay, which hardened. And down through the centuries, lime water or some other mineral solution replaced the flesh and bones, thus completing the process of petrification and leaving a perfectly formed figure in solid stone, perfect in detail even to fingernails and eyebrows. No wonder it caused a sensation. Well, so many folks wanted to see the petrified boy, Mr. Parsons had a box made and lined it with black velvet. And in this casket, the strange stone figure was publicly displayed in the front parlor of the American House up in Greenfield. The casket was placed in the center of a huge circular dining table, and the curious townspeople walked round and round, gazing on the strange stone figure, wondering which race of humans it had belonged to. The governor of Vermont at that time was John W. Stuart, and after examining the petrified body, he said, "Unquestionably, this is an Indian." But Professor Weber from Middlebury College disagreed, pointing out that the lad did not have the high cheekbones and elongated features of local Indians. Well, the crowds became so great, the hotel manager moved the exhibit into the big double drawing room. And at his suggestion, an admission fee of 10 cents for adults and 5 cents for children was put into effect. The first day, Mr. Parsons collected in dimes and nickels the sum of $165. Now, of course, the newspapers went to town on this story. They sent their top-flight reporters and sketch artists to do highly exciting feature articles. One newspaper asked, "Had these well-formed feet once so nimble in the chase, sped this handsome boy through the forests of New England when the pilgrims were on our shores? Or was he struck down a million years ago while chasing some prehistoric bird or butterfly? Pamphlets were printed and sermons preached on Lo, the Poor Indian. And a well-known leader of the coming prohibition movement took pen in hand to say, this petrified boy was temperate, no doubt, quite free from whiskey, beer, and gout, exempt from habits which destroy the health of every reckless boy. And it was true, the petrified lad did have remarkably smooth skin, well-shaped limbs and head. His eyes were far apart, and his forehead showed him to be of an intelligent race. He was, and still is, a fine specimen of young manhood. Why Mr. Parsons disposed of this money-making attraction that he dug up, nobody seems to know. But he did sell the petrified Indian boy to one Brooks Whitney of Shelburne Falls for what would seem to be a rather high price, $8,000 to $10,000, I've been told. And Mr. Whitney went around the country, touring the county fairs and sideshows and the exhibition halls, and he made a lot of money. Then along came Mr. Abner Woodward with an unusual offer. I can't give you much in cash, Mr. Whitney, but I've got some mighty fine Scotch whiskey that I'm willing to swap for that petrified boy. How many barrels? Oh, I got quite a lot of it. Probably 50 barrels. I'm not interested. Well, maybe there's nearer 100 barrels. And would you believe it? Abner Woodward swapped 100 barrels of whiskey for the stone effigy found on the bank of the Connecticut River. Now, Abner had big ideas. He wasn't going to waste his time showing his prize in grocery store windows and at county fairs. He wanted to play the big time. So he hustled down to Boston and hired an empty store at 104 Washington Street. And aided by colored posters, window cards, and handbills, he put Lo, the Poor Indian Boy, on exhibition. But somebody in the home of the bean and the cod had heard about the Cardiff Giant hoax. And poking an inquisitive fingernail into the crack of the petrified ankle, he exclaimed, ha-ha, just what I thought. Nothing but plaster of Paris and cement. Colored, I bet you, with a bit of brick dust. This is the worst fake I ever saw. Abner was arrested, tried in court, and fined. And taking his fake petrified Indian boy, he skedaddled to Canada, where it is said he took in almost enough to pay for the 100 barrels of whiskey he'd given to Mr. Whitney. Then both Abner Woodward and the petrified Indian boy dropped out of sight, and nothing was seen or heard of either of them until years later, when the box containing the petrified body turned up unexpectedly in the famous Sheldon Museum at Middlebury, Vermont. And there you can see it today, along with many other more authentic and valuable antiques. Some say it was found in the local express office, and when no one came forward to claim it and pay charges, it was given to Mr. Henry Sheldon, who was always glad to get his hands on anything new, old, or different, to add to the great conglomeration of Vermont antiques and oddities with which he was filling up his residence. And right here, I must tell you about Mr. Henry Sheldon. His was a normal, calm existence until somebody gave him an ancient Roman coin and started him collecting. He collected coins, buttons, books and old manuscripts, pictures and oil paintings, rare old china and glass, clocks and costumes, furniture, guns, the entire contents of country stores and apothecary shops. He collected stamps and square pianos, violins, old sewing machines, rolls of hand-blocked wallpaper, old phonographs and music boxes. In fact, Henry Sheldon gathered together anything and everything that had been invented or used in Vermont. And when his house was so full he couldn't get around through the rooms, he went and bought the 3.5-story brick and marble park house opposite the library, and darned if he didn't fill that up. There he lived in 2 rooms, the other 18 crammed with his glorified junk of bygone days. Local folks laughed then at Henry Sheldon, but now they say, wasn't it wonderful that Mr. Sheldon had the foresight to collect and preserve all these lovely old things for us to enjoy today? Fortunately, the heyday of Henry's collecting was during the late 1800s, before country folks realized that antiques would one day be worth their weight in gold. And because of this, it was possible for Mr. Sheldon to amass a treasure house of rare china, glassware, and period furniture, the like of which would be hard to find under any other roof except the Sheldon Museum. Don't you miss seeing all this. Next time you're up in Middlebury, Vermont, well worth your time and attention. Well, after his death in 1907, the house was left undisturbed. Then in 1935, the directors of the museum, which Mr. Sheldon had founded, got busy and cleaned house. The things they found would turn an antiquer green with envy, and they used these wonderful antiques to completely furnish several rooms, exactly as they were in your grandpappy's time. Step into the old-fashioned sitting room, and you'll find prickly horsehair sofas, a marble-top table with stereoscope, a comfortable open Great Franklin stove, and everything else to match. That handsome Windsor chair you're sitting in was brought by Oxcart from Connecticut. But as several generations of Vermonters sat in it, it was welcomed by Mr. Sheldon for his collection. Now let's take a peek into the bedroom. Furnished with four-poster bed, trundle, foot warmers, and a copy of Godey's Lady's Book to be read by candlelight. And look at the pussycat, comfortably curled up in front of the fire on a lovely old-fashioned hooked rug. That tabby cat was Mr. Sheldon's favorite pet. And when she passed on to the catnip and cream heaven to which all beloved pussies go, Mr. Sheldon had her stuffed. And she's been snoozing contentedly, head on outstretched paws, for lo, these 60 years. And out in the gun room on his velvet couch, lo, the poor Indian, petrified or plastered, has also been sleeping among such a collection of authentic things, he's been practically forgotten. When I visited the Sheldon Museum recently, curator Earl L. Cushman and his efficient secretary, Mrs. William Burridge, brought out all the papers and documents they have pertaining to the mysterious petrified figure. And they also showed me a stack of Henry Sheldon's personal diaries. Under date of February the 16th, 1884, we found in his handwriting this entry. Mr. Frederick Leland has given me permission to place in the museum the petrified Indian boy that caused so much talk a few years ago. And that's all that we could find about it. Nothing about where he got the figure, how much he paid, or where the petrified boy had been for all those years. Now, it seems to me the Sheldon Museum has a real old-fashioned mystery on its hands. And I wish somebody would answer these questions. What man or men first conceived the idea of making this figure and hiding it on the bank of the Connecticut River to be found by a hunting party in the dead of winter? Could Mr. Parsons, who was an expert carriage painter, have had a hand in the hoax? Or was it the prank of some college student? And just how was the statue made? Was it molded in clay and then cast? Or was it carved from some special composition? And how come such eminent and intelligent gentlemen as Governor Stewart and Professor Weber were so completely taken in as to pronounce it genuine? Was the placing of this faked plaster figure near the location of the prehistoric footprints and bird tracks just after the Cardiff Giant had been found a mere coincidence? Or was it what the publicity boys would call good timing? Those questions will probably never be answered, unless some heretofore undiscovered letters or records come to light. Meanwhile, lo, the poor petrified boy still sleeps in his velvet-lined box, and I think he's one of the most interesting exhibits to be seen at the famous Sheldon Museum up there in Middlebury, Vermont.